so I am here with Vincent Cassel. It's a two-part film, Marine Killer Instinct and Marine Public Enemy Number 1. Vincent, how are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for being here. It's a pleasure. I wanted to, first of all, ask you about something that I really noticed with your performance, and that is the way you often enter a particular scene and your eyes take in everything. It's casing the joint, even in a social setting. I'm curious how this evolved, if you had done any preparatory work where you basically walked around looking at people or perfecting a different kind of stare. What of this?
Well, apart from that movie in particular, I think that's what actors do. You know, it's you have to observe things, and it's the most fascinating. And, you know, sometimes it's not even really something you do on purpose, you know, but I guess being an actor, and because I love what I do, I really look at things a lot. And then eventually will come back while I'm in front of a camera. But yeah. That's part of my job, I guess.
Sure. Well, the question, too, also, is because I know you have some training in a circus academy, and physicality has become one of the things that you're definitely known for. And in this movie, I know you put on weight. There's, of course, all the mustaches and beards that you hide behind. And I'm wondering if there is a certain kind of advantage or creative advantage within these particular limitations when you're totally shifting your body for this particular part, whether this is really the way to get to the aspect of a character more so than any psychological backstory or whatnot.
Well, I think it's a mix between all that, you know, really. But I really started my training when I was 16 as a dancer. Mm-hmm. So I come from, as you were saying, yes, from the circus school and ballet and all that. And that what I got left from all those years is my taste for movement. And when we say movement, it's not really about jumping around or doing somersaults. It's really about, you know, I think each and every character has a different way to move, to hold a cigarette, to open a door. And once you have that kind of taste, you know, it's something you work on. And I'm consciously working on it every time I work on something. And then, you know, this mixed with the background and everything, you know, eventually, you know, the character comes alive.
Yeah. Does movement offer a more creative place to establish a character more so than the backstory research or anything like
that? Of course it does. I mean, look, you walk down the street, you see somebody that you've never met,
yeah,
and you've seen him walking, and you just see his back, and you already can say a lot of things about, you know, is he drunk? Is he somebody sad, happy? What kind of energy he has, you know, all that, you know.
Yeah. So I'm glad you mentioned that you use different movement, because I have noticed that about your performance. I mean, Marine and your role in Irreversible, two completely different movements. What do you do to prevent yourself from repeating a particular gait or a particular walk or a particular way of entering a room or a way of inhabiting an atmosphere or whatnot? I mean, do you worry about this, repeating yourself for each character?
No, of course. I mean, I think it's important not to do twice the same, but the main reason of that is that otherwise I get bored, you know?
Yeah.
So what I do is that I'm very instinctively, I have to say, it's not something really I think of in a very precise way, but I can feel if it's something. Actually, sometimes I start a scene and I have this feeling of déjà vu.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes I don't even really understand where it comes from, but that's enough for me to just switch to something else.
Yeah.
You know, and try something else on the moment. And then thinking about it, you know, afterwards I understand, oh yeah, I did this in that scene, you know, for that movie. But on the time, you know, on the moment, I don't really analyze, you know. It's just a question of feeling, like most of acting is, really.
Have you ever had a situation where an entire scene needed to be altered because you felt that you were physically adopting some cliche that you couldn't quite identify, but it just didn't feel right? Anything like
very
that?
Much so.
Really?
I mean, especially in a movie like Mesrine, because yeah, I'm so close to Jean-François Richer, the director. You know, we were literally like get on the set in the morning, we would try, and suddenly we're like, something is wrong, let's change everything.
Yeah.
You know, and because, you know, I think acting and movie making in general, maybe more for an actor than for a director, but it has to be organic, whatever that word means, you know. But it's something you don't have time to think too much on a movie, you know.
Yeah.
It's very much about reacting and being involved physically in what you do. That's the only way to see if it's real or not, really. So yes, you try things. It's about trying and finding solutions.
Yeah, so working something out in advance, that's pretty much the planning phase. And then when you go out onto the set and you do it, that's largely organic. What's the ratio between spontaneous performance versus really prefiguring it? Where does planning work in with this?
Well, I guess, to me, 90% of the work that an actor has to do, except for the technical stuff. If you have to learn a language,
sure,
or do a horseback ride or use a sword or whatever, then you have to do it before. But then what really will insufflate life into a character, 95% of that is on D-Day. Yeah. Well, actually, not even on D-Day, but on the second.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's what life is. You know, life, we improvise all the time, and you need to improvise even with all the things that you have to do on a set, you know. Yeah, so it's about life.
So things like, for example, Marin very fond of doing the hair and touching up his mustache. Those are all essentially improvised shot to shot to shot. I mean, how do you inform the director of sort of...
You don't inform.
You don't. No, you just do it. Yeah.
Yeah, you just do it. And if it's, you know, I mean, if you're on the same page, which should be the case, you know...
He'll give you some latitude to go ahead
and
do
of
that.
Course. Yeah. I mean, I even came back... I mean, even the lines, you know, I said... You know, for example, there's a line I'm really proud of in the movie. And you know, he's on the phone and with Cécile de France, you know, and he says, "Nobody kills me before I say so."
Yeah.
But that's something that just came up, and now it's in the trailer.
Yeah. You improvised that line.
Totally.
Wow. Okay.
And then I said, "Do you think it's right?" And Jean-François said, "Yes, yes, I think it's totally right because that's how he feels." But the truth is that because that day, you know, Cécile de France wasn't there and I was like super mad because I had to work with nobody on the other side of the phone. And I was really, really nervous, you know. And so from that nervosity and, you know, I came with this thing.
Yeah.
That's what I call accidents.
Yeah.
And if there's no accidents, it's boring.
Would you account most of your great moments as an actor to accidents?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. The other thing I wanted to ask you about, you said that you act in order to lose yourself. But do you ever really lose yourself completely? Don't you have to maintain the sliver of some aspect of yourself when you're working on a movie? Or?
You see, I lose myself in the moment, but then I'm not losing myself at all. You know, it's like I'm a pretty responsible person on a movie. I've been producing movies for like almost 6 years, 7 years now, so I know exactly what it means. I know how much it costs. I know the kind of responsibility a director has and all that. So I'm not a crazy guy, you know, at all. I can be crazy in what I do. And I hopefully there is some kind of fantasy, if it's not craziness. But there is no way I want to totally get lost. You know, I'm not a crazy person. I love what I do and I do it properly and I deliver when it needs to. But I, you know, I won't do something that would put a movie in jeopardy, for example.
Yeah. Well, like such as what?
I don't know. Some people just don't show up, don't know their lines. They get on a set totally, you know, coked out or drunk or whatever, you know, because it's a way for them to be so-called real.
To lose themselves, too.
Yeah, but
there's a risk there.
You have to lose yourself in a very particular thing, you know, and not just bring your problems as a human being on a set. You know, let's be professionals.
Yeah, of course, of course. Well, I also wanted to ask because you've said that in real life you're attracted to playing bad guys because in movies,
yes.
You're attracted to playing bad guys because in real life you don't know any good guys. But I'm wondering if you've been reluctant to take on, say, a big Hollywood role because it's simply incompatible with daily life. I mean, the sort of romantic comedy or the action movie, this is not necessarily going to be what our life is. Is this a matter of the boredom that you were mentioning earlier? Or?
No, not exactly. Actually, you know, the genre of the movie doesn't really matter. It can be anything, a romantic comedy, a Western, a spy movie, whatever. I think for me, the most important thing is that it has to have personality.
Yeah.
You know, it has to be original. It has to be at least trying to do something that people haven't seen before, you know? Then, you know, it's... say the question again, I'm getting lost.
Well, the question is, you know, the relationships between choosing a movie that is perhaps larger than life that comes from Hollywood versus our regular existence in real life.
I don't mind, you know, something being larger than life. Actually, I've been part of it, like, in movies like Brotherhood of the Wolf, Crimson River. It has nothing to do with the reality, obviously. But, I think it's... You know, once again, it's about the personality of the thing, you know?
Yeah, so that personality has to feel authentic, even though it's an illusion.
Exactly, but no, I'm finding my path again. It's,
sure.
Actually, it's about the bad guys and the good guys.
Yeah.
The truth is that when I'm saying that I don't know any good guys in real life, is that I know. I mean, we're all so complex, you know. And I mean, I can see within me that there's things that I'm ashamed of because sometimes you're not as brave as you would like to, or sometimes you do something for the wrong reasons, and that's the kind of thing you hide. And the minute you hide it, that's interesting.
Yeah.
But the good guys and the heroes most of the time in movies don't have these kind of problems, you know, or in a very simplistic way. What I found about bad guys is that most of the time they come across more human.
Mm-hmm.
and even in an over-the-top movie.
Yeah.
Because they have problems, and we all do.
Yeah. The villain is more likely to be an accessible point simply by way of the flaws are more open, whereas films are reluctant to have heroes who have contained flaws because they're supposed to be the person who the audience relates to.
Or they're very control flaws.
Yes,
you know?
Yes. And, or easily perceived flaws that don't really take a lot of risks.
Yeah, and you can resolve them while the movie. The truth is that we're not like that. I mean, we carry our burden until death most of the time.
Yeah. Well, this also makes me want to ask you, because I know that this project, Marine, was in development for 7 years, and that you initially were concerned because Marine would have been portrayed as a hero. And I'm wondering if that's something that you can't always prefigure, because you do have a very charismatic presence in this movie. Some people, you know, as myself, I was thinking, God, this guy's a badass, but he's also an asshole. So, you know, the question is that something you could entirely control? What happened here? What are these concerns? I'm curious.
Contradictions and paradoxes. I think that's the most interesting thing in cinema, in general, and actually even in life, let's face it. I'm not a religious person. I tend to think that, you know, once we die, we die. And so life is the only thing we really have, you know, and I want to experience that to the max in terms of movie making too, and in my characters too. So what I'm saying by that is that I'm just trying to I don't want to tell people what to think about a character.
Yeah.
You know, it's just that, you know, I wanted to keep all the aspects of the character. Yes, he's been brave. Sometimes he's incredibly brave and funny and even warm. But he's a racist.
Yeah.
You know? And he's violent to women.
Yeah.
You know? And I think it's the combination of all that makes the character interesting. If you get rid of, like, the darker aspect of the guy, you know, then I don't really see the point of making the movie.
Yeah.
You know, I think what you think about the character at the end of the two movies, it's not what we told you to think about him. It's more like who you are as an audience.
Yeah.
And if you liked him, and if you feel a little guilty about it, then, I mean, I did achieve what I wanted.
Yeah, I got it. So you were more concerned that the character would be sanitized in some capacity, that his true viciousness, that his savageness would not actually make its way into this project. That's really what your concern was.
Totally.
Yeah.
And plus, I think to a certain extent, of course, in a certain degree, we all have this kind of viciousness, you know, and that's what comes across. And that's why eventually at a certain point we might forgive him for some stuff he did.
Sure.
Except if you have like a huge morality. Mm-hmm.
Well, was there ever a moral question about this character? I mean,
totally.
Yeah,
of course.
I mean, just weighing your real life versus the actual.
Totally.
Yeah.
I mean, for a bunch of scenes, you know, I would turn back to Jean-François Richer, the director, and say, we're going to lose the audience, you know, with that scene, because what he does is just impossible.
Yeah.
You know? And, but then the next scene, you know, he does something that you wouldn't dare to do, and you have to admire him in some ways.
But for scenes such as the journalist and, of course, the wife, the terrible scenes, what did you do to make the actors comfortable, to make them, you know, I mean, they have to go ahead and give their emotional all, and here you have to be vicious. What did you do to sort of make things okay with
them? I'm not a heavy person on set, you know, I'm like a kid, really. I have a lot of fun. And so, you know, I think the thing is that, okay, between action and cut, you have to do things like if it was the last. But the rest of the time, you know, we shouldn't take all that too seriously.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's the key thing, you know. You still have fun, you make... I mean, Elena Anaya, that I really like a lot, I mean, she blew me away because she was ready to, like, you know, like, I could slap her in the face in a very gentle way.
Yeah.
I never hurt anybody, of course. But she would, like, you know, I would take her by the foot and just, yeah, to go down the stairs, and she would have bruises, you know, a bit and stuff. But she loved it. And she knew I loved it too, so I was telling her, you can slap me harder and stuff like that. So we really had fun, you know, doing it.
Yeah.
So it's not heavy on the day. It's going to be heavy in the movie, but doing it is something fun and easy.
One last question, because I got to get out of here, but I wanted to ask, you mentioned life earlier and how acting in some capacity allows you to live life. Well, you're 42 right now, and you're not going to... I'm sorry, 43. 43. Well, happy birthday.
Thanks.
But you're not always going to be the young man. There's a certain irony that you put on weight to play a middle-aged character. I thought that's kind of funny. But what are you going to do as your energy wanes, as you get older? I mean, what are you going to be in 50 years? What kind of choices are you going to make as an actor? You can't be young forever.
No, of course you, yeah. Of course not. But you know what? First of all, I have no idea.
Uh-huh.
Like, I had no idea 10 years ago what I would be today.
Yeah.
The other thing is that I do still have a lot of energy. I don't know. I have something. I got to be excited.
Yeah.
You know, and so I always find ways to be. And so we'll see. You know, I don't even know what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna be doing in next year.
Yeah.
So, and I don't really care, honestly.
Yeah.
What's important is right now.
Yeah. So spontaneity really allows you to cement this kind of career trajectory.
I think it's spontaneity is the key. Is the key word for. For an everyday life, first of all, and plus, indefinitely for this business.
Yeah, yeah, got it. Well, Vincent, thanks very much for taking out the time. It was a pleasure.
Thanks.
All right. Okay, so I am here once again with Rachel Schuchert, who is most recently the author of Everything is Going to Be Great. Rachel, how are you doing?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
I'm doing okay. We're talking in the heat here, but yeah. I guess it's cool.
Sort of. It doesn't really feel that way in my apartment, though.
No. Well, we're not in your apartment.
It's like, no, we're not. But,
yeah, but
know.
We could be. We could actually kind of will ourselves into your apartment.
We wouldn't want to do that.
No. I think anywhere you go, you'll feel some wave of heat. But like let's talk about the book. You mentioned this in the book, the idea of living life with which to recapture it later, or with which to write about it later. And I want to ask you about this just now. If you now live life in any capacity with the idea of perhaps profiting upon it.
Oh, yeah.
That now it's a matter of like, oh, well, this could be a nifty anecdote I could whip into an essay or into a future book. Or is there a particular statute of limitations here where you'll live life up to a point or you'll write about having lived life up to a point? What of this?
I think we are sort of reaching the statute of limitations, mostly because my husband won't have it.
Yeah.
He will not, you know, make himself, he won't let me make him in our marriage like a character in my, you know, continued exploitation of my personal experience for financial gain, which I understand.
Well, he does pop up near the end.
He does pop up near the end, but I think this is about as much as is going to be, you know, permitted if I want to stay in my life as I'm accustomed to.
Yeah.
And also, you know, I'm sort of losing interest in myself, too. I feel like you can only really write about yourself up to the point of where your career begins. Otherwise, that's most of your life is about that, you know, unless you're somebody who's like writing a memoir, like looking back on like your fabulous storied life, you know, like you're Lauren Bacall or something, and you're writing it much later in life. I feel like then you can sort of write about your career in a way that's interesting. But I feel like my life has sort of stopped, like the actual trajectory of it has sort of stopped having any literary value now that I have direction.
So your life has no literary value. What value does it have? If not literary, then what? Monetary, existential, ontological.
No, but you know what I mean. Like, I don't know that there's the same kind of. I feel like I don't have. I mean, I feel like I'll always sort of look to autobiographical instances. You know, that you know something happens, or you think of some idea, or you know you're in just some situation that's so strange, or meet someone that's so interesting that you know you sort of start to put it into a story. And I'm sure I'll still continue to write essays like that, but I don't think that I'm going to write about myself in a way where I'm almost like a character in a novel anymore.
Yeah. Well, then
it'll be more about like, it'll be almost more journalistic, I think.
Oh, journalistic, like what, for example? Like you going
like
to a country?
Like if I did something odd that, you know, there's something to write about. Like, I've been thinking about writing this essay a while ago. I had a friend that was working on as like the props master on one of those like historical reenactment shows. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like on the History Channel when they're like, and then the Tsar and Tsarina were shown into the basement room at a Catherine, like that.
Yeah.
And I was just bored. So I did a couple of days like being one of the people in it where they just like shoot you from the back in a costume. But then you like are like, you know, the Tsarina Alexandra like falling on the ground dead when the Bolsheviks shoot you.
Yeah.
Or you're like, you know, Catherine Howard walking down. Like, you know, it's all really grisly and gruesome because they're all like about like murders and executions and things like that. So stuff like that was like just. And then there was like this incredibly precocious sort of child actor on the shoot who clearly thought that this was a very big deal and his mother was there. And the child himself had all these like sort of pretentious eccentricities. Like he was speaking, he would speak in an Irish accent, even though his mother like wasn't Irish and he hadn't grown up there. And she's like, yes, we don't know why Peter speaks in an Irish accent. And I was like, he's full of shit.
Yeah, but you know,
things like that. Like it was like, so I feel like experiences like that that are sort of out of the ordinary and kind of interesting, or, you know, or funny, I'll write about. But
you want to avoid the David Sedaris problem, where you just completely mine every conceivable incident for communication.
Yeah, I did a crossword puzzle today.
Yeah, exactly.
It reminded me of when my sister used to have a bird.
But, you know? But on the other hand, this situation with the actor or this historical reenactment props master, well, that does, in fact, run the risk of the David Sedaris problem.
Right, so I think it's tricky.
Yeah.
I haven't actually written that story yet. But, I don't know that I'm going to do this for, like, another book,
yeah.
You know? Like, pieces here and there, I don't know, we'll sort of see how things go. But I think as far as really writing about my emotional life and anxieties in that sense, like, where that's really the main subject matter, I think we're kind of reaching the end of the road. So enjoy it while you've got it.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to actually address one part near the end of the book, but now that you've brought your husband Ben into the conversation, I must address two. You note near the end of the book that you've lost touch with the majority of the people figuring into the story, that you want these individuals to stay squarely within the past. You declare that corrections are the enemy of memory, but I must ask, aren't corrections also the enemy of understanding how people change? I mean, how people exist is very fluid. Doesn't writing a book about capturing anyone involve capturing their many angles, their fluidity and the like? Or why is that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it does, but I also think that you have to, and this is something that is tricky, I think, in writing this kind of book, is that it was important for me to, like, for example, somebody who, you know, who I obviously do still have a relationship with, my husband, it was important for me to write about him in where he was in that moment in time, as opposed to like what I now know. You know, I really try to like stay in the moment when I'm writing about something. So part of, I mean, and some of the people that are in the book I am still in touch with. But I really wanted to capture, you know, who they were in this world at the time, as opposed to kind of like through the lens of knowing what happened to them.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
No, that's true. But on the other hand, speaking of your husband, I'm sure you had to strike some deals here to get him into the book. And then now you start dealing with a situation where it's at the expense of truth. And you're also dealing with a situation in which you're writing about someone. They're going to come back and say, hey, that's not how it happened. And so you deal with...
Well, that always happens.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the most interesting things about writing these books. Because obviously you do like fudge little details here and there just to make it a compelling story. You know, you have to sort of reconstruct dialogue. And sometimes you make things happen a little sooner to each other than they did. I mean, I feel like that's sort of par for the course. I mean, but it's interesting to see how people remember things in totally different ways sometimes. And, you know, you remember something really honestly one way and didn't feel like you made it up. And they'll be like, I don't remember that happening, or that didn't happen that way. Or sometimes, you know, you realize, like, that people you thought knew about something didn't know about it. I remember reading a little part to my father, and he was like, well, that's not true. You made that up. And I'm like, no, I didn't make that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, there's things that people sort of don't acknowledge happening or don't know. I mean, it's interesting, like, what surprises people and how they remember it and how that clashes with your memory. But, you know, I feel, though, as a writer, I'm writing in first person from my own point of view, and it's not really my responsibility to square it with everybody's memory of events. You know, I'm making my own narrative out of it. I'm making my own sort of piece of literature out of it. It's not reportage. Like, it doesn't have to be fact-checked, you know? As far as writing about my husband, though, he always thinks that whatever I write about him is going to be so much more humiliating than it winds up being, that then when I let him read it, he's usually sort of okay. Like, I really do try to, like, keep an eye to the fact that there are things that, you know, there are things that are personal and I don't want to share, you know. And then there are things, although there's, you know, not many of those. And then there are things that I feel like, if there's something that I feel would really embarrass him, or that he would really prefer, you know, like, his boss not to know or something like that, I try to leave. I mean, I try to be sensitive to the fact that, you know, this is this other person in my life who, you know, has his own reputation to consider and, you know. But I sort of, like, let him read everything first. And sometimes he'll make changes. He'll, like, want a little change that I'm totally fine with, you know, like, can, like, I mean, because it's just like so small, and I don't even understand why he. I can't even think of an example right now. But you know, just say. I mean, and sometimes it's something so silly. It's like, well, say it was. Don't say it was that weekend because I was supposed to be because I cut work that week or whatever. You know what I mean? Like little tiny things like that. And sometimes there are things that I actually think are important, you know, as far as like the image or like the story I'm trying to tell with the description. And I can usually, if it's something that he finds sort of embarrassing, I can usually like, but if I make a case for it, that how it's important in the narrative or like what I think that having that image in or that line in really accomplishes, he's usually pretty accommodating. I have sort of final cut.
Yeah. Well, you note of Ben that as you watched him calmly rub soap into his hands by the communal sink, you realized that you had known all along that you would see him again. I'm wondering what it is about hand hygiene that serves as your personal Madeleine.
I don't know. I feel like I remember that moment. He was sort of just very calm, and he didn't seem surprised to see me. And I had sort of been thinking about him and having this sense that we would bump into each other again. And I think it was seeing him do something that was very mundane, almost like we were sort of at home together, or like, you know, even like moments now when it felt almost like we were, had skipped ahead in time and were standing like in our own bathroom while he was like brushing his teeth and I was trying to put my makeup on or whatever. Do you know what I mean? It felt very familiar, I guess, in that sense. And it's sort of an intimate act, you know, seeing somebody like washing themselves in some way or grooming.
So really any guy could have come along if they had done any kind of remotely regular gesture at that point. They could have swept you off your feet.
I don't know. I was definitely in a different place.
The title, Everything is Going to Be Great, comes from a sentiment expressed by Pete, a guy with a girlfriend who you got involved with and who had a problem hitting on other women in restaurants, including you. You became involved with him, justified your involvement by noting a Dutch study where a woman's neural activity at the moment of climax is equal to that of someone in a vegetative state. I must go ahead and ask, surely hindsight offers the basis of 2020. Lust may indeed make us do stupid things, but there's often another reason why we're driven to the irrational. So I'm wondering why you're content to sort of throw away this particular sort of self-introspection here.
Yeah, but I feel like it's sort of that's really describing that moment more. I mean, I feel like later in the exploration of that relationship, you know, sort of other reasons come to light. You know, the fact that I think we were both, and I feel like this is, you know, sort of there in the book, like as our relationship, you know, I feel like that sort of explains like why I couldn't sort of like slap him across the face like in that moment, and you know, like I can't, do you know what I mean? But as far as getting involved with him later, I feel like we were both kind of lost, we were both kind of adrift. I was at the time really lonely, and you know, things were not working out the way that they were supposed to, and I feel like he, you know, I think I mentioned how he suddenly gave shape to this adventure I was supposed to be having. He made it feel like there was a point, you know, that like I was here to have this really, to fall in love and have this sort of incredible adventure. And it turned it into like a narrative. It turned it into a story as opposed to just this sort of aimless, you know, time waster.
Yeah.
And I think that, I feel that if I had been here, if I had sort of been on my own turf, I don't think that we would have gotten involved. I feel that, you know, being abroad, you are sort of off your center of balance and away from like the kinds of practical things that you usually think about. I mean, you're so removed from all of that. I mean, there were so many things that I didn't have to deal with.
Yeah.
And I feel that because you're, you know, even though you're living there, you're sort of so removed from like your sort of base reality that you find yourself capable of doing things that you wouldn't do. I mean, you're sort of, I guess at the sort of extreme end of that you have, you know, like all these people who murder people abroad, you know what I mean? Who I don't know would necessarily have, you know, been in this situation if they weren't.
But loneliness,
that's not too.
The problem, though, with loneliness is that it's going to create a tremendous series of judgments. In the case of, for example, Phil Collins, who you you speculate upon and you take to the, you know, you go ahead and take the hatchet to him. But on the other hand, it's very clear.
Are you a Phil Collins fan?
No, I'm not. But it seems very clear to me that the fact that his male pattern baldness is very Dutch that this might have contributed something to his enduring appeal in the Netherlands.
That's interesting. I never thought of that.
Yeah, I mean, he has that kind of Dutch-like, the way the Dutch men tend to bald.
You noticed that on the football team, didn't you? Yeah. He does. He has that sort of Arjen Robben.
Exactly.
Where there's sort of there on the sides, and then there's like that little middle tuft part.
Yeah, exactly.
Like this one
the
part that just won't go away, like Charlie Brown.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's kind of funny. But a lot of Dutch guys have a lot of hair, though, too. They either have that particular balding pattern, or they have that, like, Beethoven...
Yeah, that's right.
...like,
that's,
floppy hair that, like, you know, like, bobs back and forth when they're on their bicycles.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that sort of, like, 1994...
Yeah.
Parted in the middle, floppy hair.
But to go to a more... to a less trivial subject, although probably equally as important, you know... How much was culture shock and loneliness, do you think, motivating this judgment or this failure to really sort of come to grips with everything from Phil Collins to Dutch cuisine, which I could challenge you on? They do have some pretty good meatballs, among many other things.
The meatballs are all right. Yeah, there are some Dutch food. There are some Dutch foods that I genuinely like, but there are some others that I absolutely detest. I can't eat croquettes. I think the whole I'm not a big stamp pot fan. It's really not. I mean, I feel like that's just. How can you explain why you like the kind of foods you like? I mean,
well,
Dutch
cheese,
cuisine,
surely.
Cheese I like, yeah, but Dutch cuisine sort of combines the two things I hate the most, which are gravy and things that are deep fried.
Yeah. But it's not all kale.
Which I personally don't like.
You suggest, though, it's all kale.
It's not
in the
all
book.
Kale, but there is kale worked into a lot of things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think that it's that sense of apartness, you know, that I think that writers have in general, when we were just talking about before, like, you know, that sort of feeling that you're a little bit on the outside of your experience while you're having it because you're sort of thinking about how you're going to write about it later. I feel that when you're abroad, that's even more magnified, you know, you're actually physically sort of an outsider instead of just mentally. So... You know, and then I think, but I also think that a lot of it is just the culture shock is, you know, there's a lot of humor in it. There's a lot of, you know, that sort of compare and contrast. And, you know, I feel like those parts are really meant to just sort of be funny more than point to some, you know, greater xenophobia.
Well, speaking of culture shock, I should point that you bring up the Christmas figure of Zwarte Piet.
Well, that is kind of insane.
Yeah, a racist.
I mean, let's be serious.
Yeah. A racist Al Jolson figure.
Yeah.
The Dutch claim is merely a tradition for children, along, of course, with the folk way of composing cruel poems for your loved ones and your friends and your family.
That is my single favorite Dutch tradition, by the way. I wish that we had that. I feel like that's just, instead of just getting, because instead of like, how great is it to, you know, rhyme how, you know, all of your criticisms.
Yeah. No,
somebody that you're going to get drunk and say anyway.
I think it's great, too. But I wanted to ask you, and it's not in the book, what specific Dutch qualities do you think account for these two phenomena?
Well, this inability to ever, like, let anything go. You know, like, the Dutch will always tell you exactly what they think about something at all times. I mean, and it would never occur to them to not tell you. You know, that you might rather not know. It's just the culture. It's very, very blunt. You know, they're almost like Israelis in that sense, you know. Like, it doesn't matter if you didn't ask, you know, if like, they just, it's, you know. And also this, you know, they're very insistent about sort of that it's for your own good that they're telling you this. You know, I think that there's something, and it's not always insulting, but I think that there's something in the book about when I'm trying to buy popcorn at the movie theater and he like won't let me buy the smaller popcorn because the bigger popcorn is better value.
Yeah.
And why would I do that? Because I'm actually saving money by buying the bigger popcorn. And I'm like, but I'm not, I don't want the bigger popcorn.
Yeah.
And he was like, but it's, you know, it's better value. No, you have to. And I was like, well, because if I don't want to eat the whole popcorn and I don't have enough self-control to not eat the whole popcorn. And he's like, well, then you are just a pig.
But on the other hand, you're in your early 20s, and in your early 20s, you're not as confident, you're not as familiar with things, you're going to take things with a greater, you know, as greater slights.
Certainly.
And so the question is whether you're recapturing what was going on inside your head, or whether it's an accurate depiction of this Dutch quality.
I think it's an accurate depiction, and I think that most Dutch people would tell you that it is also. I mean, it's something, it's a cultural thing, you know, it's like the way, I mean, and it's not obviously everybody, and it has like, you know, sort of things, but it's one of those things that they'll say about themselves, the way that like, you know, people in the South will say like how they have their Southern hospitality, or do you know what I mean? Yeah. Or like how New Yorkers are brusque. Like it's just, it's one of those sort of things. It's, I'm like, it's not like I made it up. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's something that they're pretty upfront about.
They're pretty upfront about, but it's going back to the issue I was sort of suggesting earlier about resorting to a generalization and not delving further to sort of to try to understand what it is. So I was using this in relation to just keeping someone or a memory of someone squarely in the past as opposed to linking it to the present. Is there a danger perhaps in perhaps not examining further, or does the nature of a comedic memoir essentially do away with such penetration?
Well, that's an interesting thing to say. I think that the essence of comedy is sort of, you know, not doing that. You know, I feel like the way that, you know, sort of humor is set up is that you take a position and that's the position that you stick to, and it's almost the irrationality of that position, or it's like unchangingness, that, you know, makes it funny. You know, it's like when a comedian says, "Why are people like this?" You know, and you can say like, "Well, not everyone is like that," and like try to, you know, get very like, you're not, you know, I mean, but that's not really comedy. But I feel like, I also feel like, in a certain way, like, I didn't write a travel book. Like, this wasn't meant to be, like, an in-depth exploration of, you know, the sort of peculiarities from all sides of, like, these different cultures. It's really about, you know, it's about one person's experience of them. It's about, you know, that narrative.
But it's also, I would argue, a series of slapstick adventures. And comedy, I would argue, is also very much about the twist, or at least it used to be, where one situation turns into something else and turns into something else, and that's what creates and sustains interest. Surely that aspect of comedy would be compatible with examining, say, the Dutch character or your own evolving temperament.
Yeah, which I think is in the book, you know, that there's these situations that go into, you know, another one, as you say. Yeah. That twist, you know, and that I also feel like it sort of takes an interesting turn where something that was this very, like, these sort of slapstick situations after slapstick situations sort of turns into something a little bit darker and, you know, and more emotionally overwhelming.
Yeah. Do you feel that you come closer to the truth in finding the comedy in, say, being date raped and the whole scenario with a dentist?
Closer to the truth in what way?
Closer to the truth by examining it from a comedic standpoint. By examining a really dark situation, such as that.
Oh, I see what
saunter
you mean.
Upstairs, your crowd
well,
is falling
out. Well, that situation,
out.
While it was certainly threatening and dark, looked at from one perspective, was actually honestly hilarious while it was happening. Do you know, like I never looked back at it. It was like, it's a little bit skeevy, and I still feel a little bit like, ooh, when I think about it. But like, it has never not been funny to me. Like, everything about it, even while it was happening, like, I was, like, screaming no, no, no while, like, laughing hysterically.
Yeah.
Which, you know, is probably not a very PC version of almost being daylight, but it was, you know, truthful to the experience itself, the specific experience.
But it wasn't entirely comedic. It was extremely,
no, it was,
I would,
also sort of harrowing.
Based off of what I was reading here, it seemed like a pretty dicey and frightening situation on some level.
Yeah, in a way. But I feel like, you know, situations are complicated. I mean, to use a cliche, it's that whole sort of laughing at a funeral thing.
Yeah.
Be emotionally devastated and also able to find something funny. You know, like, I don't think most situations are one thing or the other.
Yeah. But on the other hand, a situation, if you are taking a comedic tone, is probably going to be more ideal for the framework of a book like this than not. And I'm wondering, you know, what you did to assemble the situations that had that right ratio, so to speak, for this
book.
Of darkness and humor, or fitting the tone, or that kind of thing. I mean, there's also a sweet moment where with your mother near the end. But I'm curious about how you went about assembling or collating your various personal experiences, or offering the edited highlights, as it were.
Right. Well, I feel like some of it is sensibility, you know, that like I think that I just sort of, as a writer and as a person, I'm naturally remember those situations more than others, you know. So like when, I mean, all of writing is sort of an editing process, you know, of like this sort of vast store of experiences and memories that you have and sort of figuring out which ones are the most evocative and that you have the most to say about. And I think that I just very inherently sort of trend towards the ones that are both disturbing and funny, which is like, you know, which I could go for on forever about, you know, the, why that is. But, you know, I think that that sort of like mordant humor is just very much where I'm coming from. So, you know, these situations are the things that stood out to me. And, you know, it's like every writer, I mean, I feel like it's, you could put someone else in exactly the same situation, they would come out with a totally different experience of it. Like we were talking about how people have totally different memories of something. It's like an art class when like, you're like, you know, draw this person and everybody's drawing is totally different than everybody else's because you're coming at it from your own, you know, synapses and the way that you process information. And that's the way that I process information, I feel like. That's the filter that things come out of. And, you know, that you, somebody else could be in that situation, for example, that situation with the Italians, and be incredibly threatened and damaged by it. Somebody else might have been like, awesome, totally gone for it, you know? Like, you could put someone in that, another writer, through another writer's lens, all of these things. But as far as actually sort of picking out, so I think that I sort of picked out those situations that fit that sensibility. I mean, I almost can't explain it. It's how I do it.
Yeah. Well, if you can't explain it, is it possible that your filtering mechanism, how do you know it's right? It could be wrong. It may not necessarily.
Wrong.
Yeah.
I have no idea. You know, everything you write could be terrible. Like, all you can do is sort of do the best you can with what you've got, you know, with the perspective that you've got. I mean, I could have written this book and chosen probably totally different situations. But I also, with this book, I think, which has something to do with, like, why I sort of wrote about the things that I wrote about, I really wanted it to have sort of a narrative arc, like, you know, a sort of beginning, middle, and end, and almost the kind of structure that a novel would have. So I think that I sort of purposefully chose situations that built that. You know, that sort of story arc into it.
I wanted to also ask you about the footnote for the Are You About to Be Sex Trafficked checklist. But was that an obligation by HarperCollins Legal?
Actually, it wasn't, oddly.
Really? Oh. It was your own sort of safety.
It was my own safety. Guideline. And also, I sort of thought it was amusing.
Yeah.
As amusing as a joke about sex trafficking can be.
Well, there were a good deal of disclaimers in the first book. I was sort of surprised to see the disclaimers start to taper off with the second one.
Oh. In what
there sense? There were fewer disclaimers this time around, or fewer please don't try this at home sort of.
Right. No, it's true. It's true. I think I got sick of disclaiming.
Or perhaps, I suppose, the metafictional framework of the first book, which isn't as prominent in the second book, was something that just was less appealing to you this time around? I mean, there aren't the multi-starred and crossed footnotes this time.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I felt like I didn't want it to be, you know, that similar to the first one in that sense. I mean, I felt, you know, like I still have that sort of, just because there's things that I always have ideas that I can't figure out how to put in, but that I think are sort of funny or interesting enough that I want them to be there. So like it has those little sort of intertextual bits that are a little bit out of the narrative. But this one had a different kind of momentum than the first book too, where it was less about, it was, you know, sort of less anthropological document in a sense, or like, and I was sort of letting the story go a little more. I mean, it's not essays. It's sort of a little more, you know, through, like there's a little more of a through line. So you sort of, and it was almost, it was a bit of a challenge for myself too that I sort of set myself that like I'm not, if there's something that really needs to be in there, I'm going to work it into the book proper. I'm not going to sort of have these little extra things all the time.
I wanted to ask you about your pronunciation guide to Dutch street names. I mean, that's certainly a good short-term fix for negotiating the Netherlands, but after a while, isn't one obligated to learn the actual language?
And I did, actually. Yeah. You know, it was, but, you know, then I had sort of called them this for, so even like some of my Dutch friends started calling them these things. It was just, it became this sort of inside joke among people that I knew. But I did actually learn a bit of Dutch while I was there, which I have now a little bit forgotten. But it's actually this book and the first book are both coming out in Dutch, and I just got the translation of the first one, and it's funny to read through it, you know, because obviously I know the text very well, but I actually, because of that, I can sort of match it to the Dutch pretty accurately. Like, I remember enough to sort of remember the sentence structure. I never actually took a language class or anything like that for a variety of reasons, but I'm pretty quick with languages, honestly. I sort of picked it up.
Yeah. You suggest that the German-speaking peoples are without equal in the generation of sexual deviance, that the Austrians are also no slouches in the perversity department, and that the Swiss represent a special case. From what empirical basis do you draw such generalizations?
None, really.
None?
I mean,
that's hardly fair, then. There's perversity everywhere.
It's true. It seemed like way more people seem to, you know, think that girls were prostitutes in Switzerland than any other place I've been. And also, I remember talking to, like, some prostitutes in Holland once who told me, like, how they would always get these Swiss guys that would, like, they were the ones who would, like, knock on the doors. Like, there would be, like, a lot of Swiss guys. But I also thought it was, you know, Switzerland is oddly mysterious in certain ways, you know.
Banks, clocks,
the banks, right, all these sort of like watches, all these like tiny intricate pieces that are like, you know, locked up in something, these like secretive banking culture, and this, like, they're neutral, you don't know what they feel about anything.
Did you know that Switzerland was one of the last countries to give women the right to vote? There's one province that held out up to like the 1970s.
I think I did know that, actually.
Did you know
that? Yeah. I think I did. Yeah, it's a very weird, it's very backward and weird in a lot of ways, like, while also having all this, like, you know, it's, I don't know, there's something strange about a country that is, they're in the middle of everything, and yet they're totally isolated. And it's, I think it's really sort of made for an, you know, just this sense that, like, it's everyone's country and no one's country, you know, that there's always all these, like, international, there's Davos and, like, Geneva, and it's like this, you know, where people, like, the whole world gathers.
Yeah.
Yet, like, they're, like, one of the most insular, I mean, they've refused to join the European Union. Like, they banned the minarets. Like, it's this incredibly insular society.
Yeah, I know. Well, there's something about Switzerland, and yet you didn't entirely put your finger. We only have enigma and mystery with which to play with. Is that really a good grounds for to I suppose, throw grenades of generalizations here? Or?
Well, why not? What are they going to do? They're neutral. What are they going to do? Come after me?
There could be some secret Swiss writer.
Maybe my book won't be translated into Romance.
In response to Schuchert. Yeah. I think on that note,
Alain de Botton will be very angry.
Inviting all sorts of enmity from any Swiss listeners. Rachel, thanks so much for taking the time. It was a pleasure.
All right.